Some of you will recall 2 months ago, shortly after my return from my trip to Ireland, I ventured here among you to bring you a message about what was coming down the road from our United Methodist around the city in terms of a new ministry plan designed to bring the United Methodist congregations together in order to strengthen our witness and mission as we move forward into the future. Change is not ever easy or welcome. I want this morning to do my best to try and connect the Easter gospel, particularly this story about Thomas and his doubt, with our own life circumstances, both individually and collectively as a congregation. Because you see, here's the truth. If my preaching and our singing and our praying are only good for Sunday morning when we are in this room, what do we really have? It's when we take the gospel that we have heard proclaimed, the gospel that has begun to prick us, and the gospel that has begun to save us, and we begin to take that gospel with us all week long for whatever we are facing, that it becomes real. And I want to do it in the context of beginning a series over the next several weeks looking at some critical dimensions of Celtic spirituality, which I believe has something to say to us in the face of a new reality. On the back of your bulletin, you will see the image of a cross, but a different kind of a cross. Those of you who have attended Presbyterian churches or perhaps Reformed churches will say, "That's my cross." Okay, but it is interesting in why it is in that shape, unlike just the bare bones down and across. In Syracuse, like many other Northeast cities and cities across the Rust Belt, we honor every year, just a month ago, St. Patrick. Now, I don't think it's his Celtic spirituality that gets honored on March 17th. At least not in those terms. But if you need a quick refresher of the course, Patrick was the son of a Roman official in England when Irish marauders came across the Channel, kidnapped him along with others, and took him and those others back to Ireland, where he worked as a slave for the next 6 years of his life. Imagine, as a teenage boy, kidnapped and taken far from home. And he was a good teenage boy. So while his father was in fact a Christian, because Patrick was a good teenage boy, he rejected his dad's faith out of hand. Because that's what teenagers do. They push against much of what their parents value. But while Patrick slaved away for the next 6 years of his life, often working in isolation as a shepherd in the hills of Ireland, and with no one else to turn to, he began to pray to God every day and every night. In one of his few writings that have been left behind, in fact, he talks about every day he would pray up to 100 prayers, and every night almost that same number. He began to turn to someone, and that someone over a period of time became real to him in a different kind of way. At the end of that 6 years, he received a message from God telling him there was a ship waiting for him to take him back home to England, and so he made his way stealthily across 200 miles, finding a boat that at first rejected him, and then as he walked away disconsolate, they called him back and invited him aboard, and he eventually made his way back home, and the next period of his life is a blank, except it appears that somewhere in there he began to take seriously the Christian faith enough so that he received training as a priest. And then he heard a message to go back to Ireland. Can you imagine? Can you imagine what it's like to go back to a place where you have been held captive and to do so voluntarily? So Patrick goes back to Ireland, and unlike many, he begins to work with the people, accepting who they are, what they value, what they believe, what they trust, what they understand to be the nature of the divine, the unseen, the invisible, and begin to teach them in ways that allow them to connect what they have believed and revered for so long, connect that to the Christian story. That's not how everybody does missionary work, is it? Some people do missionary work by saying, I got the truth, you don't, I'm going to give it to you, and you just need to accept it. Patrick didn't operate that way. Patrick said, the Christian story is one that can connect with the people that once held me prisoner, because he had been watching them too. Can connect with them in a way that allows the Christian tale to be heard afresh in their own symbol system. And it was a symbol system. If you haven't read it yet, read the introduction to the service that talks about the value and beauty and wonder of creation, that creation is a good reflection of a loving creator. And that talks also about us as human beings, that contrary to the story that is still told today, by the way, that we are first, foremost, and always sinful, in dire need of salvation, Patrick told a story that said we are made in God's image, imago Dei. And while we have marred that image, it is still who we are at the heart. When we begin to talk about the relevance of Celtic spirituality today, I think it happens to be precisely at those points. But how do we who have heard the Christian gospel, who have come with joy to receive that gospel and do our best to live it out, how do we take that message out into a world that is multi-faith and multi-religious? Do we simply stand up and say to everybody else, we're right, you're wrong, and if you're going to know the truth, and if you're going to go to heaven, then you need to give up everything and become like us? I believe Celtic spirituality tells us something differently, and that cross image on the back really is a subtle and not so subtle reminder of all that, because what it has done is taken the cross and connected it with the circle. There are a couple of different interpretations of that. One is simply, it's a reminder that the cross is an eternal message. But here's where it really gets interesting, perhaps an even more truthful background. It has taken an image of the nature religion in Ireland, namely sun worship, and has connected the story of the cross to an ancient faith tradition, and said these are not in contradiction or opposition to each other. They are very much compatible with one another. Now, some would see a move like that and accuse it of being accommodationist or syncretistic. And Patrick would say, this is how we begin to tell the story so that people can both hear it and claim it for themselves. A couple of weeks ago, Nelson Price walked several of us through, right here in this space, the new document that lay folks from around the city have been working on. That document will be before the gathered body tomorrow evening. I didn't check. Check me, somebody. It's 7 o'clock? 7 o'clock at Gethsemane Church. We are praying that that group representing members of all the congregations will take a look at that revised document and say yes to it. And if there are some substantial changes to deal with, we'll wrestle those through as a body. You are more than welcome to be part of that process. And then on Wednesday night, assuming that that document moves forward, the new leadership team that will bring together representatives from all of the city churches together with the assigned pastors beginning July 1 will begin to form a new leadership team and think through how this is going to work. Unfortunately, my own plans have me out of town for Monday night and Wednesday night, so I will not be present. However, there are leaders in this congregation who will be present. And the working relationships and understandings that we have developed over the past 6 years makes me utterly comfortable and confident with the fact that those folks will fully represent this congregation and your interests as they begin to be in dialogue with others from around the city. But I do want you praying for the meetings Monday night and Wednesday night, and praying for those who will be part of that. I can tell you this much about tomorrow night's meeting, that along with dealing with the document, they will also hear from the district superintendent who the new pastor team is going to be. And it will be a group of persons who will be assigned to the city of Syracuse, period. Not assigned to University Church, not assigned to St. Paul's, not assigned to Gethsemane, not assigned to Brown Memorial, not assigned to Irwin First, and all eight in that order, but assigned simply to the churches of the city of Syracuse, and then begin to develop a pastoral ministry plan that embraces all of those churches. There will be some continuity. A number of the pastors who are already in the city will continue come July 1. I can't say any more than that. But I can say a number of the pastors in the city will continue. But we will be working in new ways as we come to July 1. And we will learn together how to make that happen effectively. One of my concerns as a pastor is that so far very little has been focused on theology. At the heart of who we are as people of faith is what we believe about God and how God is at work in our lives, in our congregations, in the world around us. About 50 years ago, a theologian named H. Richard Niebuhr took a look at all the different ways that he could identify in which Christ and culture, Christ and the world around us, intersect. He identified 5 basic models that range from everything over on this end that said Christ and culture are one, and in agreement with each other, to at this end, Christ and culture are in opposition to each other and should have nothing to do with each other, with three mediating positions in between. Now, this sounds like arcane information and totally irrelevant to anything else, but I want to suggest it would be an interesting dialogue to have with the bishop and the district superintendent and the other leaders from other churches to ask the question, how does your church understand its connection to the world around us? So it's possible, I don't know, but it is possible to imagine there is a church around us that says, our position is that we have nothing to do with the world around us because we are saved, and the only way to be saved is to keep ourselves pure and spotless and disconnected from the evil world around us. Now, how in God's name is that church going to connect with another church that says, we believe that God has called us as Christ's ambassadors to be at work in the world around us, not just blessing the world, not just helping to transform the world in the name of God and Christ, but daring to believe that Christ is already at work in the world around us, and part of our responsibility is to begin to recognize what God is already doing and jump in with God. You hear the opposition? And at some point, we've got to have some theological conversation with our brothers and sisters about how we understand our purpose, our role, our mission. Theology is at least as important as a conversation about nuts and bolts, about who's going to be where and who's going to do what and how we're going to foot the bill for all of that. My prayer for us is that as we go through this week and as we go through every week of our lives, we will take the story of Thomas and make it our own story. You have heard me in the past say, I believe Thomas gets a bad rap. Thomas gets labeled the doubter. And Thomas is told, well, that's nice that you've come on board, but blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. I want to reframe that story. Go back to Easter evening when the disciples are still grief-ridden and consumed with fear. And Jesus shows up and breathes his peace upon them and into them. And a week later, when fear and grief are now joined by doubt and uncertainty, and Jesus shows up again and breathes his peace upon them and into them. I think the story really is a way of saying, wherever we find ourselves, in fear, in grief, in doubt, or anything else, Christ can find a way into our lives and bring us peace. My ending word today. And if these were to be the ending words on my deathbed, could they be any better? Peace be with you. In the name of Christ, always. Amen.